The Emergency Room presents unique challenges for life science companies. What are the pitfalls and opportunities of the ER for biopharma? I'm Jeff Stewart of Syneos Health Consulting. I'm joined today by Ruth Henriques de Rosier, Medical Director here at Syneos Health. Ruth works in ERs to test new therapies for trauma and other emergencies. What biopharma needs to know about the ER, next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Ruth Henriques de Rosier, welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to join you today.
The reason you're on is that you're a medical director here at Syneos Health, but you worked many years in the ER. Could you just begin by telling us about that?
Sure. Of course, the ER is territory of the unknown, right? When it comes to medicine, you see everything and anything. Having lived both on the East Coast and Central United States, you see different aspects of the medical room. So my background is internal medicine, but I've worked doing a lot of clinical trials in the emergency room. So I got to see a lot of interesting cases, whether gunshot, stabbing, or poison ivy in weird locations. I got to see a full spectrum of different aspects of what comes through the emergency room. It's unpredictable every day. Patients come critically ill. And then here you have running clinical trials. It's a very interesting scenario in combination to make that all work together.
So a clinical trial and an ER don't sound like the ideal mixing situation. Am I right?
You're absolutely right about that, simply because you don't know who's coming through those doors at any moment. It could be a psychiatric patient. It could be a gunshot wound patient. It could be a patient with a heart attack. And we have clinical trials in all those areas going on in the emergency room. So at what point do you speak to that patient? It depends how critically ill they are to see if you can even approach them. I've seen cardiovascular trials, for the most part, do very well. Patient come with acute coronary syndrome. You can still speak to them, have family there who are quickly listening to the process and intervene. It's more difficult when you have trauma patients come in.
I imagine. And the reason to talk to them is so that they get consent and understand why they might be part of a clinical trial.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a difficult process. You have to be quick, fast, and still thorough, right? Because the patient needs to make a fully informed decision to enter the clinical trial. For the most part, a lot of times family get involved. They're the ones asking the questions, which is absolutely fine. Before we get that signature on the dotted line, we want to make sure they fully understand what they're participating in and understanding what's involved with the particular clinical trial.
So when you see a clinical trial protocol that's proposed for the ER, do you, based on your experience, at times just know it's not going to work?
Yeah, some of them won't work, especially when you have your trauma patients. It depends on what avenue or what process is involved in a clinical trial. It may be difficult because if a person comes with multiple gunshot wounds, it's hard. There's not a time. It's urgent. You have to move the patient, stabilize quickly, and move them to the OR for the most part. So the time to have a conversation, not because the patient might be hypovolemic, their IVs going on, not even conscious to approach them. So those are more challenging and difficult. If you have a patient with potentially still trauma, but stab wound, maybe you have more communication. They're still telling you what happened, what occurred, what hurts. You're still trying to assess alertness of the patient. So sometimes you can actually speak to that patient and tell them, hey, there's a clinical trial that potentially could be beneficial. We don't know, but here's what it's about. Are you interested? It has to be quick as well. They have to be well informed, know the risks, potential risk involved, and then sign on the dotted line.
Wow. This podcast is heard primarily by those in the industry, maybe not someone who's in this specific area or they haven't really approached this. And I've had some clients that are in that situation where they are planning clinical trials or are conducting clinical trials or about to approach the market with something that's in the trauma space. What do you have to know that's different from what most biotech companies, most pharma companies might think about the ER?
I guess the critical aspect of the patient. Usually you have critically ill patients. I can think of, let's say, a cardiovascular trial where a new procedure that's similar to a catheterization procedure where you're trying to decrease the temperature of the body, that's still a bit invasive. But for that patient who comes in, they have chest pain, you are doing EKG, you're doing several other things to assess what's going on with the patient. At times, depending if they're conscious, if there's not diabetes involved where everything else is happening, you can speak to that patient and approach them. But at certain times, some trials, especially for major trauma trials, it's hard, especially if you're at a trauma center, usually institution. Those are where we see the most bloody, gory patients come in. They're helicopter choppered in and coming in, so it's urgent. There's not even a minute or a second to spare. That patient is seriously critical, or a pediatric patient. They are already mostly, for the most part, stabilized. The rest of the stabilization of that patient occurs in the OR. So is there a time to consent that patient? No, because they're too critically ill and every second matters at that point. Those are the challenges. And when I see certain trauma type clinical trials where we're potentially involved in gunshot or vessels or some type of repair, it depends. Some patients, if they're not critical, yes, you can approach them. Otherwise, for the most part, you can't. There's not even a time to talk consent. It's stabilize the patient and take them to the OR.
But what do you do in those situations? Does it just mean that the clinical trial can never fill if it needs patients that are that critical, or even something, and I don't know this, but I'm just guessing that patients that have severe concussions might not be legally competent. Can they sign? I just don't know what you do in those situations.
In those cases, right, you would try to get the consent so that whoever is their established healthcare proxy, they have those situations where who is the next person, next of kin in line that can sign off and say, okay, especially for trials or cases when there is no other, let's say, medication to involve that critical patient, whether they're allergic to a broad spectrum of things, who knows what comes in. Sometimes all you have is compassionate use of a clinical trial. For those, sometimes we do have some consent, compassionate use readily available, because we know this is a trial that it's difficult to find patients. The critical ones that you're looking for, that particular segment of patients don't have too many options. Let's say for a brain injury, then they have compassionate use, and that person always usually has someone in line to help, whether a spouse or a parent, if it's a young adult, to sign off and make use and get them into that clinical trial. That's usually because, okay, nothing else can be used. This is the best option we have right now.
The clinical trial recruitment and consenting, while challenging, can be overcome. I'm just gathering, it's hard to imagine a scenario where a particular patient type would never be able to get to the trial. You'd never be able to fill it, because even in those cases where they're incapacitated, there's somebody else to potentially to give consent.
Correct. Whoever has legal authority, yes, they can. And sometimes even in the OR, right, the patient becomes stable, or they're stabilized before going into that full procedure. They're stable. We're starting to see them come awake and speak. They're not under anesthesia yet. That investigator, depends on your investigator, those aggressive investigators who believes in a separate option, hey, we have a clinical trial going on. And even then, sometimes you do get consent for those patients. But of course, safety is the priority when we bring them in.
If I'm a biotech firm, I'm listening to this and saying, well, my product might be facing some challenges, but we'll be able to overcome them, at least from the clinical trial side. But I have seen other ones. I'm thinking actually back, this is about 25 years ago, before I worked at Syneos, where my client was an inventor who had invented a laptop-sized x-ray that was being used in the military at the time, next level. But he didn't really understand the trauma market. He wanted it to be placed in ambulances and counted up the number of ambulances in the United States. But that's not what an ambulance driver or crew does.
No.
They do not x-ray things.
No.
And no. So it was just like a non-starter, but they didn't know it. How does a biotech company that's thinking, hey, my product would be great in the ER, do this gut check of actually understanding whether or not their product will work there? I know it's scary because everyone wants their product to be exactly as they envisioned it. But sometimes they do have a great product. It's just not right for the ER. It's just not right for the ambulance, but is great for outpatient use or is great for inpatient use. How do you recommend that a company that has what they feel to be a great idea for the ER setting figure out if it really is a good idea for the ER setting?
I would say location, 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 right? Consider the city that you're in. Is your product for inner city environment? Is it more for countryside environment, because all of those gives you an idea of the type of injuries that occur and where you'll have and can apply them. That's one location. Two, there are plenty of emergency medicine departments now including clinical trials as part of something that they include for patients as options additional. So those are the areas you target, because those emergency rooms already know they have nurses who are familiar with clinical trials. They have fellows there who are familiar with clinical trials, attendings. Everyone knows how quickly and fast, but are invested in bringing patients a different option. They already know the risks. They know how to quickly triage, assess the patients quickly, and know which ones you can approach and which ones are no approach. I've seen also ERs where it's set up that way. If they know they're doing clinical trials, there's an area already quickly designated. So once that patient goes to that area, you know whether the nurse or whoever is involved with the trial, they're paged and immediately there to quickly consent the patient and get them involved. So I think location is important. Where are you? Where is your trial most applicable? Is it inner city? Is it more suburbs that you'll find the patient population? Of course, we have our outliers, right? That they'll end up some remote place that it's not typical inner city, but they have those types of injuries nevertheless. But targeting institutions that have clinical trials as part of their system, even if it's not directly in the ER, if it's a cardiac trial that you're doing, but they have a cardiology department that does clinical trials, even then, there's a liaison that goes quickly to the ER and can consent the patient. So it's depending on the site. I think that's critical. Understand what institution you're going to use. What framework do they have? How quickly do they move? Do they have SOPs in place to address that trial? Then you'd be set. Then it's not so complicated. And they're not taken aback by it, right? Because they're accustomed to moving quickly and understand how to approach the patients.
So I work mostly in market access. And one of the things I've noticed, and I don't know if this is universally true, but hospital inpatient costs are very closely monitored. The hospital doesn't like high-priced anything. And it comes out of their skin, essentially, because they're being reimbursed based on the patient and whatever they do to the patient, that's on them. Versus in the ER. When it's in the ER, then all bets are off in terms of price sensitivity. The ER isn't necessarily on the hook for paying it. It's the insurance company. So it's just very, very different financial incentives. If you can get something in the ER, you can have it at a high price. If you get it in the inpatient, then maybe you have to price it at a few pennies. It could be that dramatic. Have you seen that?
I have seen that. So let's see. The more critical the therapeutic area, of course, if this is a life-saving mechanism, then it doesn't matter, right? We're approaching because in that scenario, you want to save lives. And if there's a better way to approach this patient, for sure, that's the avenue that's going to be taken. That's sort of that gray area for price. And of course, there's administration perspective and there's clinical perspective as well. So clinically thinking as a physician, you're thinking, look, this is the fastest way for me to salvage, save this patient. And it happens to be an investigational product. The patient is okay with it. Let's go. That's why I think it's easier for that gray area where price is not such a big factor because it's a life-saving intervention.
And does that just extend to anything that needs to be given early? I'm thinking of some of the COVID drugs that would be given in the ER setting because you have to give them or you want to give them early. But that also puts it in that favorable reimbursement category for the hospital, as opposed to, oh, this patient is going to need to be in here. We're going to need to intubate them. Let's get them in here and then we'll give them drug of choice. No, they try to do it in the outpatient setting first.
Absolutely. Especially with COVID. My goodness, have we learned a lot after having several deaths and knowing that, hey, there's a different intervention available. Absolutely. That's going to be your go-to because you don't want to lose more lives, nor does the institution want to be associated with those numbers. Then it becomes favorable when both sides, a patient is getting the best as long as they are agreeable to it, and then you're saving a life.
There's not just danger in being in the OR setting and risk for a pharmaceutical company or a biotech that's going in there, but there are also some upsides. At least once you understand those, then it can be a better place to be. So even if your product could be in the inpatient setting, could be in the outpatient setting being the ER in this case, then the outpatient setting is often more favorable, but not universally.
Absolutely. And then patient population also, right? Where are you going to find, especially if it's a product that's set up for critical, that critical point, where are you going to find them? It's going to be the urgent care centers and the ER. Urgent care centers is another hot zone because a lot of patients don't want to go to major hospital institutions for everything. They'll show up at an urgent care and you're open for 24 hours. Those are another area where you'd be very surprised. The patients being more agreeable, patients wanting to do something different, much more easy than a large institution emergency room because they're looking for, let's go. I don't want to go to a large institution. Some, believe it or not, will pay out of pocket. So you have all different scenarios when you come to urgent care sort of emergency room. Those are another area where clinical trials are doing well and shouldn't be underestimated by pharma industry as well. Diverse populations are not an issue because you get it all in the emergency room. You don't get to pick and choose, oh, let me see 10% of these patients have to be. You get it all.
The reason that diverse populations are important is kind of twofold, as I understand it. One, the regulators are asking for it.
Absolutely.
And then it's good medicine.
Yes.
You have to know how things work in different populations. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, the old standby of white men doing most of the clinical trials didn't always work out so well.
No. And in emergency room, there is no choice. You receive everyone, you speak to everyone, they want to participate, you get it. So you have full diverse population without even having to try.
Ruth, this has been very helpful. Kind of one final question and then we'll wrap up. I have to think that COVID has changed how clinical trials act in the ER setting. I don't mean just during the height of COVID when maybe things were just so chaotic that clinical trials must have been extremely challenging. But how do you see clinical trials now going forward as things move out of the declared emergency of the pandemic, as hospitals are not under constant danger of being overwhelmed? How does that change from the good old days of 2019?
I think people are more accepting and agreeable at this point because during COVID, at a certain point, it's anything that works at a certain point to put your hand on. Imagine long hours, volumes of patients, no beds. I mean, you're using every single area. And at this point, if there was something that brought relief, absolutely. And so that, I think, remove the blindfold of, no, it's a clinical trial. We're not going to consider. People are considering it even more from patients as well as clinicians. So I think it's a great time for our industry to enter emergency medicine clinical trials even more so, whether it's psychiatric, neuro, from stroke patients to cardiac patients to respiratory, opioid use. We see it all, right? This is a great time because people are more open and receptive to it after COVID, from patients as well as clinicians.
Ruth Andrés Desrosiers, thank you so much for joining us on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. If you want to talk through a hard decision you're making at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. For access to more future-focused, actionable life sciences insights, visit the Syneos Health Insights Hub at insightshub.health. Syneos Health, shortening the distance from lab to life.